hppodcraft.com.
When murky winter dusk begins to settle over the railway station at Crewe, its first-class waiting room grows steadily more stagnant, particularly if one is alone in it. The long, grimed windows do little more than sift the failing light that slopes in on them from the glass roof outside and is too feeble to penetrate into the recesses beyond. And the grained, massive, black-leathered furniture becomes less and less inviting. It appears to have been made for a scene of extreme and diabolical violence that one may hope will never occur. One can hardly at any rate imagine it to have been designed by a really good man.
Really good man? What about a mighty good man? What a man, what a man, what a man, what a really good man. I never get to drop in salt and pepper on this show ever. And maybe I'm just not trying hard enough.
Yes, you do need to try harder because that's actually En Vogue you were singing.
It's salt and pepper with En Vogue.
That's right, but it's En Vogue that sings the chorus. And actually, they're reinterpreting the song What a Man, which was originally sung by Linda Lindell in the late 60s. It was a super popular song in 68 and became so popular that it attracted the attention of the KKK.
What?
Yes, because Linda was a white singer, and she sometimes toured supporting James Brown and Ike and Tina Turner. When the KKK found out about that, they started threatening her for associating with black people, and she dropped out of the music business.
No.
So thanks for bringing all that up, Chris. Welcome to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. Yeah. We're here at hppodcraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
It's Walter Delamere month. Don't be bummed out.
Yay.
Oops, Mervemmer. We've got a special one for you this week, I think appropriate to the Thanksgiving holiday. It's got some interesting fall imagery in it. It's called Crewe, and we're not talking about Crewe, which is my chosen brand of pomade. You know, Chris, great hair isn't a one-man job. It takes a crew. I'm just trying to get some free pomade, so hopefully somebody at that company heard that. This isn't that kind of Crewe.
No, this is a place. Crewe is in northern England, East Cheshire, south of Manchester.
Yes, and at the top there, we heard about the railway station in Crewe. Who was that reader?
What are you asking? That's my wife, Rachel Lackey.
Yes, she opened up the month, closing it down. And I also wanted to point out that the music for this episode and all the episodes this month has been provided by Wesley Slover from his album Impressions of the Miskatonic. Mm-hmm. As always, we will link out to it in the show notes. Go check it out. There's other stuff at his Bandcamp page that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
This story, Crewe, I really wish I could sum up in just a few sentences because when you do, it sounds so preposterous. But doing that would spoil things and I don't want to do that. Let's get into it. Step by step.
The story starts off with the narrator in a train station in the city of Crewe. Mm-hmm. It is cold and dreary, kind of creepy, not too many folks waiting around. Narrator overhears some men leaving the waiting room talking about a ship that came in after being missing for some days.
They're talking about the ship Hesper. Something strange apparently occurred on board that everybody in this story seems to know about, but as readers, we're left in the dark. Mm-hmm. It says certain mysterious and tragic events had recently occurred on board. There had been a full moon at the time. The ship was at present in want of a second mate. So something terrible happened to the second mate. Mm-hmm. Hesper to me sounded a little like the Demeter from Dracula, you know? Yeah. Like it seemed like maybe some vampire incident happened on board. This is just a launching pad for the story, so Delamere very well could have said, yeah, there was a vampire ghost on there and everybody knows it, you know? It would... Since this is just the jumping off point and he didn't have to be weird about it, yet he still can't help himself. He holds back the details. We never find out what happened on the ship Hesper.
Well, look, if he did go, oh yeah, there was a vampire on board, that would kind of be misleading and also extremely disappointing for the rest of the story.
Because you would never find out what, I want to know what happened with that vampire on the Hesper. Yeah, that's a good
point. Like, oh man, that's an awesome story. What? This is the story we're stuck with?
Well, I wouldn't have been disappointed. I've read a lot of vampire stories before. The featured monster in this story, I don't think we've ever had in a story we've covered.
No, I don't think we have.
Yeah.
There is another man in the waiting room who doesn't seem to notice that the narrator is there, and he starts talking to himself. But then when he sees the narrator, he starts talking to the narrator.
Yeah.
He says that those men who just left, they don't know what they're talking about. And the guy comes over and he's like the small man and he's got a coat that's two sizes too big for him.
He has a flat, grayish face. He's kind of elderly. The gigantic coat, though, was comic to me because I imagine this isn't actually a guy. It's like a group of kids trying to pretend to be a grown-up, maybe. They're all standing on each other's shoulders in this giant coat.
I thought it was David Byrne. That's what I pictured.
But it's clear by this story about the ship as a segue that what the guy wants to tell our narrator about is some supernatural stuff. He's like, they don't even know what they're talking about. I can tell you some things.
So this kooky guy says that you're safer on a train than you are in your own bed. You know where you are in a place like this, too. It's solid, though. And then the narrator says, oh, it certainly looks solid. And then he goes, but what is solid? Come to that? I thought so myself, but now I know different. So it's like, oh, dude, this, I felt this circumstance before, the very real verisimilitude moment where you're stuck talking to somebody who is talking about some stuff you really don't want to hear about.
Right. If they say, you know, all of these things around us aren't solid, really. And you go, oh, no, this is either going to be an amazing scientist or someone who's just nuts. Or maybe this man's been attacked in the past by Kitty Pryde.
Yes.
Or somebody who can phase through objects. So he's just nervous. Wants to spread the word.
So the guy's sitting right across from the narrator now. He says that this guy's a bit off-putting at first. He didn't think he was, but now that he's right there in front of him, he doesn't like the look of him. He said that he needs a haircut and a shave and maybe some sleep. He just looks really rough.
Yeah, like maybe he's a drunk or something. But he doesn't ask for a drink. He doesn't ask for anything. It seems like he just wants to talk.
And then we learn that this guy is called Mr. Blake. And Blake, he's getting ready to lay down a tale.
Clearly, this is the same kind of character as we had last week, in that he's there to talk, not have a conversation, not ask questions about the narrator. It's steamrolling time.
But what's different about this and last week's story, which I really enjoyed, what that guy was talking about wasn't relevant to the story, whereas this character is telling us the story. So he is an unreliable narrator to the point that I couldn't really connect too deeply to the story. Because I just kind of think, well, he's just a crazy guy. And at no point in the story do I ever not think that.
Okay. I took him at his word about everything that happened.
So Blake says that he was a gentleman's servant when he got started off, first boot boy under a valet. And then I'm thinking, being ultra rich is so weird to me. Like, I just don't understand how you've got so much money that you've got not just a valet. Like, that to me is like a nuts having a valet. But then you've got a dude under him. You've got a first boot boy.
Yeah.
So is there a second boot boy or just a crew of boot boys that are around?
As many as you want.
I mean, how many boots do you have?
Do I have personally? I have one pair of boots.
Yeah, I have one pair of boots. But I mean,
so therefore, I only have one boot boy. I get your point. Blake says it's all cat and dog when you're a domestic as well. You know, the servants get jealous, they fight with each other, and most of them are hanging out hoping they'll get a nice payout when their boss dies. So there's kind of an incentive to get other people out of the house as well.
So Blake goes on to say that he was never married, and his last job was with this guy, Reverend Summers, out in the far country, away from civilization. So in this house, there was Blake, this young guy called George, and a woman who came in from the village to cook, but she didn't actually live there because the Reverend didn't really like having women around the house. The Reverend had a sister that he got along with pretty well, but then Mr. Blake says this, which is kind of strange. They had grown up together, nursery to drawing room, and that covers a multitude of sins. Not sure what he means by that. What does he mean, covers a multitude of sins?
That's a biblical expression. In Peter, it says, above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins.
I see.
And there are multiple interpretations of what that means, but basically I think it's that if you have a deep love for others, it both prevents you from indulging in sins and maybe atones for weaknesses that you might have.
I see.
You know, he says he didn't really like having women around the house, so you think maybe there's something going on there, but he had a good relationship with his sister, so we can't speak ill of him.
And she would sometimes stay at the house.
The description of her is not too generous. Like him, she was, but more of the parrot in appearance, a high face with a beaky nose. There's a lot of weird parrot imagery in this story, actually.
Yeah. His sister never liked the vicarage. It was cold and dark and vaulty, high windows that young George would have to clean. George was also from the village, which is not really much of a village. It's just kind of a few cottages. The Reverend was wealthy by birth, so he had a lot of his own money, which Blake knew before it came out in the will. So when he says that, we know that the Reverend has died.
And despite having money, the Reverend was not particularly ostentatious. He did like the finer things, so the silver was really nice, and his food was always top-notch. Excellent, fresh fruit. It actually goes into a lot of detail about the kind of great stuff that they ate there.
Blake says that he was well paid for his work, and the Reverend was an easy guy to look after because he just liked his books. One thing that he didn't like, however, was smoking in the house.
Yeah, and Blake is pretty smart about one thing. He says, tobacco's not my trouble, never was. Keep off what you don't need, and you won't want it when you can't get it. Wow. It's a good way to live your life.
The Reverend said if he died while Blake was still working for him, that he would be remembered in his will. He says this, As a matter of fact, he had given me to understand that if in the meantime, for any reason, any of us went elsewhere, the one left would have the lot, but not death. There, as it turned out, I was an heir. But he's not complaining. He's got enough to last him. And then he says, who wants to go, I should like to ask, early or late? And nothing known of what's on the other side. He's talking about, you know, he doesn't want to die.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's the only one still alive of all the people that work there, and it's good to stay on this side of the tomb as long as you can. Don't muck around with it.
Why? Because while some fine day you will have to go down into it, you can never be quite sure while you are here what mayn't come back out of it. There'll be no partings there. I've heard them trolling that out in them chapels like missile thrushes in the spring. They seem to forget there may be some mighty unpleasant meetings. And what about the further shore? It's my belief there's some kind of a ferry plying on that river. And coming back depends on what you want to come back for.
Interesting, so he's saying you go over the River Styx on this ferry after you die.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the dying across the river, but also probably brings some folks back when it's coming to get you. And who knows what they're back for. And it's setting up the plot, but I liked the imagery here.
Blake says that the vicarage has a bit of a reputation as a creepy place. Two vicars before had it exorcised.
Yeah, they actually performed an exorcism on the place. He says candles and holy water, that kind of thing. Sheer flamummery, I call it. I love that word, flamummery.
He said that there were noises in the place, creepy noises that didn't really bother him, not at first. But the gardener, a Scottish gardener, who I guess is basically Groundskeeper Willie.
How can you not think of Groundskeeper
Willie?
Yeah, Groundskeeper
of course
Willie.
It's Groundskeeper Willie. I mean, his name's Mengus, but...
Mengus.
Come on, it's Groundskeeper. I mean, even when he describes him, he sounds like he's Groundskeeper Willie. Anyway, he says that he was a crusty customer, and he lived at a lodge with his widowed daughter. Wasn't there another widowed daughter in All Hallows?
Yeah.
And his grandson. And she had a son as well.
Yeah, it must be a domestic situation that he's familiar, the writer's familiar with.
Seems that the rift between Blake and Mengus started when Blake was picking fruit and veg.
I think he's angry because Blake is just going out and grabbing stuff without asking his permission or without getting the Reverend's permission. He says, what if I wanted a few grapes for dessert or a nice apricot tart for the Reverend's luncheon? And our Mr. Mengus has gone home or he's busy with the frames. I don't hold with all these hard and fast restrictions. So Blake is just a little more lackadaisical about picking things out of the gardens. And Mengus seems to be a little micromanagey about it. Which I could see. That's definitely a typical workplace dispute that you would have.
Sure, yeah.
You need to get approval from me. Wait, I gotta find you every time I need to do this simple thing. Ah! You know, and then you butt heads.
So occasionally he would offer Mengus a drink and he would take him up on it. And by a drink, I mean booze.
Yeah.
Sometimes they would be buddies. Other times Mengus would get all bent out of shape, depending on whatever mood he was in.
Mm.
Also for Mengus, he had a bit of a drinking habit.
The narrator knows it's a weakness for him. So it's kind of a manipulative way for him to make up. I'll give him some booze and then he won't be so mad at me.
Mm-hmm.
But this habit of having a drink seems to get a little worse with Mengus. Like, he's drinking all the time.
Yeah.
Says, oh, it was a thousand pities. The Reverend, believing that everything around him was calm and sweet, while there was nothing but strife underneath. There's many a house looks as snug and cozy as a nut, but crack it and look inside. Mildew.
Yeah.
I liked that a lot.
Now the scene is set. He goes into what happened during the hot summer 5 years ago. Blake would leave the pantry window open where Mengus would get into the house booze.
Yeah.
Since he had a bit of a problem, Mengus would just keep slipping little snorts of the hooch.
You think that Blake left that open for him on purpose?
Yeah, totally.
Well, Blake says, practices like that, sir, as you will agree with me, can't go on. From being secret, it began to be open. It had gone too far.
One of the decanters gets broken, and he figures the groundskeeper was too drunk and he dropped it and he busted it.
Right.
So since he and the Scott have had a tough relationship, Blake gets poor young George to go have a talk with him about this decanter.
Yeah, Blake seems like kind of a jerk.
Oh, yeah.
That even though that he's the one telling the story and he's a little unreliable, we're still getting snippets of his personality. And he presents it as if I'm doing this because I have a tough relationship with Mengus. But I think he just wants George to do his dirty work. Because if Mengus gets mad, he can throw him under the bus and say, oh, hey, I told him not to get up in your business. I don't know why he's doing that, you know. It's kind of like how my sister and I would backstab each other when we wanted to ask my dad for something. Neither of us ever wanted to do it. So we'd go back and forth. You go ask him. No, you go ask him.
Oh, I see.
I'd be like, finally, okay, fine, I'll go ask him. And then I'd go, hey, Dad, Julie wanted to know if, I'd still get it in. I'd still throw her under the bus somehow. Like, I'm only here asking because she asked me to do it. And that's what he does to George here.
So it seems George is a bit slow, but not stupid, he says, but I think he is a little slow. Mm. Usually he has a hard time finding the right words but he's very trustworthy, George. So the next day, the Scottish guy comes to the pantry window. He's already drunk. And he says, "Where's George? I want to talk with him." And he says, "I'll teach him to come playing the Holy Moses to my own daughter." Was he messing with the Scottish guy's daughter?
No. I think he might have asked her to pull an intervention on her dad, maybe.
Ah. Okay.
He, in turn, pushed the job along to somebody else. So he went, "I don't want Mangus to get mad at me. I know what I'll do. I'll talk to the daughter and get her to do it." So it's a little telephone game, and it finally comes around, and he's like, he shouldn't be coming up in my family, talking to my daughter, talking about how I drink too much. Where is he?
So Blake says as long as George does his job, it's none of his business what he does in his off time. But if,
see, boom, he threw him under the bus right there. Yep. He did it immediately.
But if George thinks something is off, it's his duty to report it to the Reverend. Mm-hmm. So the gardener thinks, oh, that's your game. Get me fired, and you two get all the money. So, because they know about the inheritance and the Reverend's not doing so well. So it seems the gardener has been having a hard time since his grandson has been sick and he hasn't been sleeping and he's been drinking, of course.
So we can have some sympathy for him. I mean, there's stuff going on in his life.
But Blake doesn't really seem to have too much sympathy for him. And he tells him and George to bury the hatchet. So, of course, he's the one that started this whole fight between the two of them.
You guys just gotta go work this out. This doesn't have anything to do with me, even though I started it.
So then he says, "What else can I do?" And then just stares at the narrator for a while. The narrator's like, "Oh, wait, this is not a rhetorical question?"
There's like, "Just go on. I get it. What could I do?" Right. Well, you could have said nothing and kept yourself, but fine. You've absolved yourself of it.
So the narrator says, "Well, if he was anxious about his grandson, it might explain his being a little short in temper. Besides, I should like to hear what came after."
He's getting interested in the story now.
It seems the gardener attacked George by the stables, roughed him up. Not like stabbed him or anything, but beat him up, punched him and stuff.
I think he beat him up pretty good, though, because his face is looking all messed up.
So Blake hopes the Reverend doesn't notice that George has been beaten, but of course he does.
Says all I could get out of him was that he had decocted some cock and bull story to account for his looks, the like of which nobody in a census would credit, let alone such a power of questioning as the old gentleman could bring to bear when roused. So what do you think his cock and bull excuse was? Oh, what, these black eyes? No, it's no big deal. I played a couple of sets with James Brown and the KKK got mad. Nothing to do with this domestic situation here. Nothing to do with Mangus drinking. Anyway, the Reverend doesn't believe it, and he fires Mangus right away that night.
So Mr. Mangus comes back that night to tell Blake off. He seems sober and was speaking in a low, quiet tone.
He's pretty shaken up having his family to care about and being near 60 and having just lost his job. It's a dire situation for him.
Yeah. So the next morning, they find Mr. Mangus dead. He hung himself in the barn.
Yeah.
Blake talks about death a bit and how after a person is cremated, that there's only a small bit of ash left, that we are mostly not here. We're mostly not matter.
Something that our last story was a little preoccupied with, What is it that makes a person? Surely it's not just this shell.
Mm-hmm.
There's something inside.
So after his death, the Reverend took care of the gardener's daughter and grandson as if they were his own.
It really affects the Reverend, this death of Mangus. And it says he was never the same again after it happened.
Though Blake noticed things were odd, that there was a strange vibe or a strange silence about the house.
There was a strain, so to speak, as you went about your daily doings. A strain. And especially after dark. It may have only been in one's head, I can't say. The atmosphere is like charged now after this suicide.
So the Reverend is taken ill after the death of Mr. Mangus. And so from his bed, he had Blake come in and he thanked him for all the hard work that he's done. So he's kind of seems like he's getting ready to die.
Mm-hmm.
He had some kind of stroke, but he seemed to be doing okay for the time being. So later on his way to the house, on a path, Mr. Blake sees a scarecrow out in the field. And as far as he knew, it wasn't there before, and he didn't know who would have put it there.
There's no way he wouldn't have known about it, because he's been in those fields all summer. So he's like, maybe some of the weird country people out here just put it up? I'm not sure.
So he got some binoculars, and he looked at it, and it looked like a scarecrow. And then he got George, and he had him take a look, and yep, he saw it too, so it was there. There was something else strange about it, that the air around it was quivering, and George thinks it's because of the heat, but Blake's not so sure.
Yeah.
So it was getting late and they retired with the intention of checking on the scarecrow the next day. The following day, the scarecrow was no longer there.
It's no good in this world, sir, putting reasons more far-fetched to a thing than are necessary to account for it. That you will agree. Some farmer's lout, I thought to myself, must have come and moved the old mammon overnight. But that being so, what was it ever put up for? Harvest done, mind you, and the crows, one would think, as welcome as to what they could pick up in the stubble. So that should have been the title for this story. Unseasonable Scarecrow. That's the weirdest thing. What's it doing up? It shouldn't be here.
Why is there a scarecrow up? Yeah, that's making sense. So we're getting a scarecrow story. That's,
yes.
By this point in the story, the monster finally shows up, and it's a scarecrow.
It is, which is cool.
That night, the harvest moon, it was out, and it was very bright, almost like day. And George was off somewhere, and Blake wanted to get another look out in the field.
What time the old gentleman's gruel was gone up and George out of the way, I took yet another squint through the glasses from the upper windows. And I'm ready to own that something inside of me gave a sort of a hump, sir, when, large as life, I saw that the scarecrow was come back again. Though this is where you'll have, if you please, to go careful with me. What I saw the instant before I began to look, and to that I'd lay my affidavit, was something moving, and pretty rapid too, and it was only at the very moment I clapped the glasses onto it that it suddenly fixed itself into what I already supposed I should find it to be. I've noticed that, though in little things not mattering much, before. It's your own mind that learns you before what you look at turns out to be what you expect. Else, why should we be alarmed by this here solid sometimes? It looks all so, but is it?
So, wow, it looked like that scarecrow was, like, moving really fast through the field, and then as soon as he put the glasses up, it stopped as if it knew it was being looked at. It's pretty awesome.
So during dinner with George, they both could swear that they heard someone talking, but not being able to understand what was being said.
Right, just something in the house. It says, they dropped upon us and between us as if there was a parrot in the room, clapping its horny bill, so to say, motionless in the air. More of that parrot imagery.
So after the meal, George goes off to bed. Blake checks in on the Reverend, and then he goes to bed himself. In the morning, he sees George, and he looks rough. Trouble sleeping, he guesses. The doctor comes to check on the Reverend, and Blake gets in a good bit of brown nosing. So that night, Blake says something unnatural is going on.
He throws on his winter overcoat, which was given to him by the Reverend. It's the same coat he's got on while he's telling the story to our narrator, which explains why it's so big. It's a hand-me-down.
He goes to check on George, who was awake and as white as a sheet. Something was outside. An animal, probably. Mm-hmm. Blake tells George to go look outside of the house, and he'll look inside. What a jerk. Yeah. He's sending this kid outside, and there's something creepy going on. Mm-hmm. George asks if Blake thinks that he's come back again. You know, that he is italicized, meaning he thinks Mangus, maybe he's come back.
Right.
He says the scarecrow, but it seems like he might be meeting the old gardener.
Well, regardless, they got to check it out, and they don't want this kind of thing going on and disturbing the old man, so.
Right.
Let's do it.
He tells Blake he doesn't want to go alone. And Blake says, you didn't do anything wrong. There's nothing to be afraid of. And I was like, well, wait a minute. If there's some monster or some beast outside, why would just not doing anything wrong protect you? I guess maybe that if he thinks it's vengeance that's out there, like it's the spirit of this guy and he wants vengeance, that, well, if you didn't do anything wrong, then he's not after you.
Yeah, I think that's that's the gist of it. Yeah.
But that's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Basically, Blake is afraid. He doesn't want to go outside.
Of course not.
So he says whatever he has to say to get George to do it. So it's funny that he's the one telling his story, but he still can't hide his own manipulative nature.
Yeah.
He should have just gone down and checked it out with him. But George goes out by himself.
So Blake hears some noise, the wind and a moan, and then he does his rounds around the house, and then he goes back to bed.
I just sat down on the bed on the place where George had sat and waited. Then presently what I heard was as though a voice had said something very sharp and bitter, then said no more. There came a sort of moan, and then no more again. When I got back to my bedroom again, everything was still and quiet. And I took it, of course, that George had got back safe. So he didn't even go check on him after he heard the moan that ended suddenly.
No.
He goes, I don't know what that is, but I'd better go to bed. I don't hear anything else. So I'm sure George is fine.
So the narrator says, did you manage to get any more sleep that night? To which Mr. Blake answers, that was the mistake of it. He wasn't found till morning, cold for hours. Precious little to show why.
At this point, I think our narrator kind of says something sarcastic. He goes, so you did manage to get a little sleep.
Yes.
And then he says, your share, I suppose, was quite a substantial one. So I think the narrator's implying you didn't go out and help that guy because you wanted to win this reality show that you're, the Reverend was putting you through. But then Blake says that, as it turned out, wasn't so, though why it would take a half dozen or more of these lawyers to explain. And even at that, I don't know as what I did get has brought me anything much to boast about. So this whole myth of, you know, whatever servants are still around when I die are going to get stuff in my will, Totally crackers. The lawyers made it so that that wasn't the case.
Right.
He got screwed. And this whole thing, it feels very, you know, convincing servants, hang around long enough and then things will work out for you. That seems a little suspiciously like religion to me. You know what I mean?
Sure, yeah. Or trickle down economics.
Do what your lord asks of you. Your reward will come later.
Later. Not now.
Right at this moment, their conversation gets interrupted by a porter who comes in with a bucket of coals. And he seems to know Blake, this porter. Mm-hmm. Maybe Blake hangs out here all the time telling people the story. I'm not sure.
Good evening, sir, he said, and in that slightly indulgent and bantering voice which suggests past favors rather easily earned. Let in a little light on the scene. I didn't notice you when you came in and was beginning to wonder where you'd got to. His patron smirked back at me as if any such trifling human attention were a peculiar solace. This time the porter deliberately caught my eye, and his own was full of meaning. It was as if there were some little privy and ironical understanding between us, in which this third party was unlikely to share. I ignored it, rose to my feet and clutched my bag. A passenger train had come hooting into the station, its gliding, lighted windows patterning the platform planks. Alas, yet again it wasn't mine. Still, such is humanity, I preferred my own company just then. When I reached the door, and a cold and dingy prospect showed beyond it, I glanced back at Mr. Blake, sitting there in his greatcoat beside the apparently extinguished fire. With a singularly mournful look, as of a lost dog, on his features, he was gazing after me. He seemed to be deploring the withdrawal even of my tepid companionship. But in that dreadful gaseous luminosity there was nothing, so far as I could see, that any mortal man could by any possibility be afraid of, alive or dead. So I left him to the porter, and, as yet, we have not met again.
That's the end of the story. I like that he kind of pulled the phony cell phone call thing there to get away from the guy, because he went out. Oh, this isn't even my train. You know what? I'm just going to stay out here.
Yep.
Let him think I caught this train. I don't really want to go back. Plus, the porter exchanged a look with him like,
You're dealing with that guy now.
You heard the Scarecrow story too, huh? Yeah. We call him Captain Scarecrow.
Having a dude tell you a story that really isn't that scary, that I don't necessarily believe. He's probably making this stuff up. There's just no weight to whatever it is that he's saying because he's just some guy in a train station.
I know, but I got to give him props for having a haunted scarecrow.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if there was anything before this where there was a menacing scarecrow, because it's almost like a trope now, right?
Oh, yeah.
Although the origin is a little weird. Normally, I mean, you would probably think that whoever animated this scarecrow to get revenge would have somehow been connected to scarecrows in their life.
Sure.
Or they were murdered out in the field and their blood got on the scarecrow or something. But instead it was just like, yeah, there was this gardener who was drinking too much. A guy turned him in, so he hung himself and came back as a scarecrow. What?
Why a scarecrow?
Because he's a gardener?
I guess.
I would think he would have come back as some kind of Audrey 2, you know, or creeping vine tree.
Sure. Or just a ghost. Just a spectral dude.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's sort of a stretch that he's a scarecrow, and it kind of comes out of nowhere in the story. As opposed to the first two stories that we covered this month, which were very confusing to me, and I felt I had to decipher. I mean, there's bits of this I still felt that way about. But generally, I got the story. I just didn't think it was a very good one.
Well, also, I wonder, like, if this scarecrow was frightening for these characters, does that mean they're part crow? Like, that's a thing that never gets addressed. Because I look at scarecrows and I feel nothing. You know, that's how I know I'm totally human. So it fails on the, you know, the hybrid crow front.
Yeah.
Most stories we read fail on that front. But it succeeds on the scarecrow murder front. So yeah, I give it a thumbs up.
Really? You give this whole thing a thumbs up just because of that?
Look, man. So we had... The first two stories I wasn't as into. The third one was amazing. This one,
yes.
I still really enjoyed it. It was better than the first two. And yeah, I don't know. The craziness of it appealed to me.
Yeah, no.
I did not see that scarecrow coming. It was like...
Of course not.
It was like I watched the, you know, the first half hour of Stripes and then suddenly it turned into Friday the 13th. It was like, what? It just really had a quick turn.
Yeah, it did. Absolutely.
I didn't expect. And I don't mind that. Things are too predictable.
Well, unfortunately or fortunately, oops, Mervemmer is now over.
It was a resounding mixed success, I believe.
It was a resounding mixed bag.
Yeah.
I have to say that I really did love last week's story of Recluse. I thought that was really good, right up there with Seton's Aunt, in my opinion.
Definitely. And I thought this, I liked all of it to varying degrees. I wasn't mad about any of it.
All right.
Well, well, next week we're going to cover another story that was mentioned in the events at Poroth Farm, one of H.P. Lovecraft's favorite writers, and that's by Sheridan Le Fanu.
Yeah.
The story is called The Familiar.
And it's a bit longer of a story, so we're going to take a couple weeks to do it, I believe.
Yeah, I think we're going to break it out into two. But that's what we're covering next time. I want to say thanks to Rachel for reading for us once again. You did a great job, as always.
Thank you so much, my dear.
And thank you to Wesley Slover for providing music all month long from his album Impressions of the Miskatonic. Go check out the link in our show notes and pick that up if you like good stuff.
I like good stuff.
And that's all we got this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.